We should get underway. Let me just check on sound. Broman, you hear us okay? Okay, good. John, you can hear us okay?
Yep.
Excellent. Thank you. And Shelley?
Yes.
Cool. That'll do. There's a few others that are not back yet, so we shall continue on. So before the break, we're talking about the way that we create the victim mentality is that we mistakenly, when it's us, other people do this as well, is we mistakenly think that the adversity has created the consequences, when in fact it's our beliefs about that that create the consequences, and that leads to victim mentality. When we look at that, then there's lots of expressions of that. So here are some common beliefs creating consequences kind of thing. When you feel like your rights have been violated, then obviously that's going to lead to anger. So you can see a link there. Whether your rights have been violated or not, that's another question. When you can see that there is a loss, of something, or a loss of self-worth, so whether it's physical, mental, or emotional, or spiritual, then loss creates sadness and depression. Loss of hope, all of those sort of things. So once again, these things are not difficult to work out, although most people are unaware that our belief creates a feeling, and that maybe it's a belief that's a problem because maybe there was not a loss. In fact, I was talking to a client recently whose husband of 20 years turned around and said, I can't do this any longer. It's over. And she said, well, is there somebody else? And he said, no, but there will be. And I started exploring the situation. There had been no sex for 11 years. And when we explored it, what had happened is that the husband had taken himself out of the family home to do various kind of like good things on regular occasions. So it's very often off at yoga. Genuinely, actually off at yoga, not off having an affair, but just off at yoga, off at book club, off at this other thing. And so when the client was saying to me that she was experiencing loss because the marriage has come undone, there was no opportunity for counselling, the husband said, you know, there's no need for us to discuss this because I've fallen out of love with you, or I'm, you know, it's not being fixed, it's over. Then she's expressing enormous amount of loss to me, and I'm saying, yeah, but have you really lost it, or have you lost an illusion? Because if there was no real, genuine meeting of hearts in this relationship, then perhaps then the relationship was more in your imagination than it was in reality. And over a period of about a month, she came to that conclusion herself, is that there's actually not loss, but there was perceived loss. Kind of, she thought that she'd lost a relationship, and she had, but she'd lost it 10 or 12 years beforehand, and that it was an illusion of a relationship, not an actual one, and that she'd been making it into a relationship that did not exist. So if you can get that, then you can see, well, yeah, there's sadness and there's depression, but it was kind of delayed because the realization of the loss was delayed. So really what I'm getting at here is that that's an illustration of the opposite, of thinking that something that was there that never really was in the first place. When we consider that further, then basically if you look at threats that are around the corner, then what we get to experience is fear or anxiety. Those threats may happen or they may not. So the actual reality could be that those things are going to happen, or maybe they won't. Mark Twain is famous for saying, I've had a lifetime of troubles and woes, most of which never happened. So, you know, that's a good illustration of how anxiety and fear can be created simply by the expectation of them. The violation of another person's rights. When I do something that takes away from somebody else, then I will feel guilt about, you know, either the damage I've done or the loss to the relationship or the things that have happened there. And of course, if there's a loss of status, then maybe that leads to embarrassment, etc. Once again, all of these things may happen or may not happen. We're really just talking about the most likely consequences of some fairly common beliefs. If you get that, then we can go to the exercise that goes with that. And so we can really say, okay, so because our beliefs are very often inaccurate, or our beliefs about our beliefs, so to speak, are very often inaccurate, we often suffer pain that is completely unnecessary because of our making something wrong. So this is in our vernacular, what Mary and I do is we talk about this about you're making me wrong. In other words, I may or I may not be wrong, but you're making me wrong is an invalidation of how I feel and where I'm at with it. So if we use the ABC tool, what we can do is we can check that our beliefs are accurate or not and whether they're working for us or not. So that thing that we referred to before the break, basically, if we can describe the event objectively, this happened, then that happened, the result of that was blah, 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 that's our first step. The next thing to do is then say, okay, so this is what I thought and this is what I did. So these are my feelings and my actions. So that's really just kind of like, if I was coaching you, I would first of all say, tell me what happened, knowing that you could only tell me your version of what happened. Does that make sense? Just nod or wave? Because that to know what was happening in that marriage that I was just talking about, I'd have to go and talk to the husband as well. So the first thing is I say, tell me what happened. The second thing is I say, so what were your thoughts around that? What did you think took place? And I'll say record your thoughts because thoughts really indicate beliefs. So beliefs are quite often encapsulated in thinking. This is where you hear people say, how could they do that? Why would they do that? Why did you do that to me? These are often thought processes. They are very closely interlinked with C, which is record your feelings and actions. So I will say to people, tell me what happened. Tell me what you thought. Tell me.
I think Paul's frozen. It must be too cold in Canberra. I think he's frozen.
Okay. What was that, mate?
Yeah, I think it must be too cold in Canberra. You just froze there for a minute.
You started telling us about number C and then you froze. So we haven't heard anything on number C.
Oh, okay. So it must have been frozen for a while.
Yeah.
Okay. So, C is thoughts and actions, which in the previous slide, it was consequences. So what I'll say to somebody is, tell me what happened. What were your thoughts about that? What did you feel and what did you do? Those three questions could take an hour. Well, they might be spread over a 1 hour period. That could happen in 5 minutes, depending on the ability of the person I'm talking to articulate what's going on for them. Because some people are able to put into words what they're experiencing quite easily, and other people struggle. And there's everything in between. In many cases, when I ask people to tell me what they were thinking or what they were feeling, what happens is they have a go and then they say, well, now that I've said that, it's kind of not like that. What I meant to say was blah, 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 and they have another go. And if you think about it yourself, like how often have you had a go at explaining something and then thought to yourself, I need to have another go at that. So with all good intentions, they can tell me what they were thinking and feeling and need to have another go at it. When it comes to describing the event, well, there's a few different versions of that. What I'm saying, I think when I froze, is that B and C almost run together. That a lot of people, when you ask them what they felt, will tell you what they were thinking. So I can say, how did you feel about that? And they'll say, well, I thought, you bastard, how could you do that? After all the time that we've been together, I thought you must be having an affair. So they tell me what they're thinking, but I asked them to tell me what they were feeling. We quite often confuse conversation with communication. They're quite often different. Okay, are we up to speed? Do you guys get what I'm talking about?
Yep.
So this is a sequence of working with yourself or working with someone else. It doesn't actually matter who, but, you know, since you guys are here, we'll work with you. So in describing the event objectively, what we want to focus on is the who, the what, the where, and the when. These are the W questions. You'll notice there's one W that's not in there, and that's why.
I ask why. My sense of humor.
Well, you're not on your own, mate.
I think we covered that a couple of slides ago, Bromas.
Teachers at school didn't like me either for asking some of those obvious ones.
Okay, when it comes to, tell me what you're thinking. What I want them to do now is I want them to do some causal analysis. We don't want to go into, you know, that rabbit hole of why. We want to go into the causal analysis. So this girl that I was talking to, whose husband set us over after 22 years, I said, okay, so why do you think he's fallen out of love with you or whatever it is? And she confided into me a lot of things that were actually her responsibility. She said, well, I've let myself go. I'm probably carrying 25 kilos that I shouldn't be. I used to be really fit and fantastic, and now I'm a bit of a sloth. It came straight out of her mouth. It was the first thing she said. It was probably a pretty accurate observation. So from that perspective, a why may be helpful, as long as it's not the rabbit burrow kind of a why. Do you guys understand what I mean by causal analysis? Because I explained it a couple of slides back, but we didn't spend forever on it. Okay. And then the next thing is, okay, so what do you need to do now? So our process is, okay, tell me what happened. Why do you think that happened? We know about your feelings and your actions, but what's the best plan for you right now? And this girl said to me, I think I need to facilitate a divorce. I said, well, when we started, you were resistant. She said, oh, yeah, I can see that. What I thought I had, I never had. Pardon me. I can see that what I thought I had, I never actually did have. I'm experiencing loss and grief now that was actually taking place 10 or 15 years ago that I've been ignoring, and that I actually don't want to have a relationship with this person because then they can't be bothered, and that the best thing I could do is get out of here, and that would be good for me, but it'd also be good for him. Does that make sense? Okay, so from that perspective, the process, the exercise for you to look at is what we need to do is add to that. So hopefully if you understand this process, let me go back. Actually, what we'll do is I'll run you through this. So I'll get you to bring to mind a situation that was difficult. Jot down your thoughts. Jot down your feelings. Just do that now, just a couple of minutes. Just bring to mind a situation that you struggle with that was difficult. It can be current, it can be old. Start by describing it objectively. You probably only need notes for this. What was your thinking? And what was your feelings and actions? The format for that is, when you're describing it, is a who, what, when, where, and when. the changing of it is to look at the causal analysis, why you think it happened, and then what is the new thought? I'll get a couple of you to share this. Have you completed that problem?
Oh, I haven't. I thought it was working.
Cool. Your head came up, so I thought, ah.
I can
see the tops of everybody else's head because they're looking down at their page.
I'm probably looking at my notes.
But I can see your face.
I'm looking at my notes.
You're done, Gary?
Yep.
Okay, run us through it, mate.
Dealing with when mum was, she's been having a fair bit of anxiety and fear.
Yep.
And I was getting frustrated and coping with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And what my thoughts were, she was experiencing loss of her sight and not being in control anymore.
Yeah.
And then the actions were that I sort of sought out some help from the doctor for a psychologist to have a chat to her outside of the loop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Just go back to your thoughts again.
Yep.
Your thoughts were?
That she wasn't coping because of her loss of sight.
And yeah. Yep. So what about the idea that she's not coping, not because of the loss of sight, that's the trigger, but the loss of sight creates what?
Loneliness.
She was
Yeah.
So what happens is you want to deal with the loss of sight, so you do things about compensating for the loss of sight when in actual fact what she needs is a cure for loneliness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tried suggestions, but she's not quite taking it on board yet.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the next step then, is that the suggestions are all probably going to be pretty revolutionary because they're all going to be new things.
Mm.
How old is she?
She was 89 last birthday in April.
Yeah. So I'm not too sure that we should be expecting an 89-year-old to suddenly try a whole new bunch of stuff. Yeah. Got the same thing with my mum. Her world is shrinking in around her.
That's exactly how mum describes it. She said because of the eyes and things, it's just not. Yeah, her world is just shrinking.
Yeah.
No one in. Yeah.
All their friends have died.
I missed that, Brian.
And when they're getting older, all their friends have died or they're not available to visit them.
Yeah, and they don't, and with COVID too, they haven't gotten out. The world's been that one little room.
That's right.
Hmm.
I think the other thing, and I see this with my mum, who's 93 next birthday, is she's really concerned that one of her children will die before she does.
Yeah.
And I remember saying when my brother-in-law passed away, no parent should ever have to suffer the loss of one of their children. It's not just the fact that all of her friends are passing away. I think she's concerned that one of her kids might pass away before she does. We're all pretty healthy.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that doesn't change her view.
No, that's right.
Because she got all day to think about it.
Yeah.
It's, if she was preoccupied with, something that she was interested in, there would be less time for her to be focused on losing someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we all need purpose. That's why we all need something to be going on with, no matter how old we are. We need to be productive. We need to, it's a funny thing. We need to be productive. We need to be useful. We need, this is for us, right? We have to produce. Generally speaking, the stuff we produce, we give it away.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my grandmother used to crochet those squares, the wool out of wool. And if you get enough of them and sew them together, they make a blanket. And they make a blanket for, you know, a poor person or a soldier or whatever. And she used to churn those things out like crazy, man. Like, you know, it's just, she'd buy the wool herself and was given away. It was all about having an action, a purpose to be involved in, whether it's a garden or whether, you know, that's why grandparents are such brilliant babysitters. In fact, great grandparents are brilliant babysitters because the interesting thing about children, particularly children under, say, about 5 or 6 years old, you'll hear grandparents all the time talking about, oh, the great thing about being a grandparent is you can give the kids back when you're finished with them. You know, you don't have to change dirty nappies and you don't have to put up with tantrums and all that sort of stuff. And I reckon that that's actually just a surface thing. It seems to me that what happens to grandparents is that grandchildren bring the grandparents into the moment. Mm.
Yes.
And because they're in the moment, they're happy.
Yes.
So it's kind of like, you know, I look at Mary playing on the floor, playing blocks with the three-year-old, thinking, you know, wish they'd finish so that I could have a go, because I wouldn't build that tower like that.
You're way right.
Yeah, that's right. But it's actually about being present. It's actually about feeling the joy of being alive, because when you're in the present, you don't have an age. Yes. Right, the only thing that I noticed with my three-year-old is my knees. So getting on the floor and getting up again, you know, those things are not as quick and easy as they used to be. But I'm not, I don't have an age. I'm not a number of years.
Mm.
And so I think that we should be careful with that. We should be aware that being in the present nullifies chronological age, if you can ignore your physical aging, and that renews your soul, that revitalizes your spirit. And if it takes grandchildren to do that, then encourage your kids to get on with it.
Yeah. Very, very brief grandmother story. We were playing hide and seek the other day here, and I climbed and hid in a tree. My 6-year-old granddaughter found me, and she stood there with her hands on her hips and said, "Grandmothers don't climb trees."
Yes, I do. Grandmothers should climb trees.
Yes.
Okay, so Gary walked us through one. So somebody else want to walk us through the one they figured out?
I'll go.
Shoot.
Describe the event objectively as working with my sister. I think she wants matters her way and she doesn't consider others. And I feel that she wants control and hates control. Probably challenges my wanting to have control. She does have a history of overstepping and not having boundaries. And when she does some of these things, I get annoyed. I tend to be mopping up the mess sometimes. So how do I deal with it? Well, deal with my wanting to have control and maybe my judgment of the situation and just keep the peace until we no longer have to work together.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's a great example of what have you come to teach me? Yeah, that's a really good piece of observation, Brahma. Yeah, well done. Shelley, you're leaning forward in your chair. Does that mean you want to share something?
Well, I can. We had an event where our neighbours wanted to build a house next to our shearing shed and it was very, where they wanted to build the house was very close to our shearing shed. Their 20-acre property used to be part of ours. And that created a lot of fear, it was for us. A lot of fear, actually. And the house was supposed to be, they could only build it if it was an application for a B&B, but the house was for one of the family members. And it was the B&B component and as close to the our shearing shed that caused us concern. And, yes, it was interesting because on the surface of it, it seemed okay, but we felt quite fearful about it. And we had to leap into action to put in an objection, even though we were hoping that the council and the procedure would reject that application. But dealing with the fear was really interesting.
That's, I'm interested in that. What was the fear? What was triggering the fear?
The not being able to control what was happening on their property, being so close to our core business. Because we're wool growers and we do a lot of activities around the shed and the animal treatment area. So it was not being able to control what was happening just over the fence.
Yeah.
We weren't against the building, but just at the site. We wanted it further away from our shed. And it was interesting that the process didn't protect us, so we had to really become quite active.
Just follow me through these steps. When you're experiencing fear, are you in the past, the present, or the future?
At that point, probably the future.
Because to experience fear in the way that you're describing it, you have to be imagining. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So generally speaking, what the thing that we can tell ourselves about fear, any time that we're experiencing fear, whether it's me up on the roof or you're dealing with the neighbours, the reality of fear is we're using our imagination to terrorise ourselves. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so what happens is, who's terrorising you?
We're terrorising ourselves, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can deal with that situation and say, well, my preference is that they build it further away. But I don't need to go into terror. I don't need to go into fear and panic and carry on. That makes sense?
Yes.
Because you'll probably be more effective. When you're not having the fear, you'll probably be more effective in dealing with the situation, because people in fear don't make quality decisions. We make our best decisions when we're cool, calm, and relaxed. That makes sense, Shelley?
Yes, it does.
Sweet. Okay. There's also what we turn it into. Are you familiar with Sydney at all? Have you seen Sydney? Shelley, you've been to Sydney?
Yes.
Okay, you know the Harbour Bridge? Just beside the Harbour Bridge, on the western side of the north end of the bridge, is a place called Luna Park. You heard of Luna Park?
Yes.
Mm. Okay. Behind Luna Park, there's a vacant block of land. Now, Luna Park has been there since 1928 or 29. There's a vacant block of land behind Luna Park. So a developer bought it and put a high-rise building there. And so people bought units in that high-rise building, and then they got together and they complained about the noise from Luna Park and had Luna Park shut down. Make sense?
Yes.
No,
it doesn't make the slightest bit of sense at all.
Mm.
But you can see what people are doing.
Mm.
Yeah, what I'd suggest to your next door neighbours, if they build a house beside an existing business premises, then they should expect some consequences of that, and they should grow a brain and move it away. Does that make sense?
Yes.
They may or may not grow that brain and move the building away, but it shouldn't interfere with you conducting your business because you were there doing that before they put the house there. Therefore, no need for you to be afraid. Make sense?
Yes.
You know, if they don't like the smells, that's okay. They could have put the house somewhere else. I'm sure on 20 acres, there's another building site, isn't there?
Several.
Mm-hmm. So make sure that you don't get embroiled in something that there's two things. What's my business and what's what I need to be aware of and what isn't. Like that, does that make sense, Shelley?
Yes.
Cool. Cool. Everybody clear with that? Everybody clear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. The main thing is fear. To experience fear, you have to go into the future. What you do then is in the future, you can't predict what's happening, so you're imagining it. By definition, what that means is you are using your imagination to terrify yourself. And we'd be better off to use our imagination to come up with a solution. But a logical, well thought out one, not a reactionary one. Everybody cool to move on?
Well, just a point. So that then ties into earlier when you say adversity beliefs and consequences. It's actually our beliefs that create the consequences.
Hang on, mate. Hang on, that's breaking up. So can you just say it a little bit slower?
Yes. I can see how that would tie into earlier when you have adversity beliefs and consequences. And where the beliefs
are created. I'm not getting it, mate. No, I'm not getting it. I can't understand. It's breaking up.
Try
turning your video off, Bromin, and then have another go.
That's what you're talking about fear, because if you can't predict the future, but you're experiencing fear because you're thinking that's going to be the future.
Is that? Bring us the microphone, Paul.
Yeah, I don't think it's the internet data. It sounds like someone's got a hand over the microphone.
Yeah, we're not getting it, Bromin.
Just leave it then, you go.
Okay, we'll move on.
If you type it in the box, I can read it to him.
Okay.
Okay, whack it in the
little voice in the background there, Paul, watching over all of us.
Yes, mate, that's God.
That's right.
I've got my video off, John, because I'm doing other work, and apparently I pull distracting faces when I'm doing other.
No, I know that, Julie. I know you're listening.
Yeah, she's got the video off because when she gets a shitty email from someone, or she gets an email that's really difficult for her to deal with, she pulls a frown on her face because it's difficult to deal with. But everybody thinks that she's frowning at what they're saying. Well, all right, we'll move on. Okay, so the next thing to look at is, okay, how do we deal with resilient thinking? How do we make ourselves think in a resilient way? Well, the first step is to say, okay, how do I shift into a positive mindset? This is very close to the idea of reframing. So what you can do is identify a recent difficulty and then identify the cost to you in it and then identify the alternative actions. So what that looks like is, okay, to shift into a positive mindset, you could make a list of things in your life that are enjoyable. Like, I've got a nice house, I've got, you know, lovely food to eat, I've got, you know, plenty of air to breathe, those kind of things. In other words, before you tackle a situation, it might be a really smart move for you to say to yourself, what are the things in your life that exist now that make your life have the quality that it does, that you appreciate? This is a very similar thing to giving feedback to an apprentice. When we go to the apprentice, we find something great to say before we give them some critique about how they're working. So what that's meant to do is set up a positive mindset. Then we articulate the nature of the struggle. At that point, we go to ourselves, okay, so what am I dealing with here? In Shelley's case, how to get the neighbour to be convinced that they should move the building. That might include things like, can we conduct our business, etc. Then identify what the costs are as they exist. In Shelley's case, it might be that, you know, every time we go to do drenching, we've got to tell the neighbours because of the smell. Or we're going to do something that's really noisy and maybe, you know, they're going to object to that. So there's all sorts of time and money getting around that, and et cetera, et cetera. Maybe it's just frustration. So what you see here is these first three steps are basically designed to set up a thinking process that says, look, I'm coming from a good place. I'm actually living a great life. In Shelley's case, looks like you live in paradise, Shelley. I look out that window, it doesn't look too bad a view to me. Do you live in a nice place?
I do, thank you, yes.
Uh-huh. I presume there's a roof over your head.
Yes.
Yeah. If we went to your pantry, would we be staring at an abyss, or would we be staring at what people in the third world would think was a supermarket?
Oh, yes, a supermarket.
Okay. So, and it looks like you've got some pretty nice warm clothes on.
Correct.
Uh-huh. How much do those glasses cost?
$2, actually.
$2.
But I get your meaning.
Yeah. Even the $2, like, you know, normally they're $1,000, right? But
yes.
Even the $2 ones, people in the third world cannot go down the shops and buy them. They don't exist. They don't sell that stuff. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yep. So that's that first step. Make a list of what makes your life enjoyable. The fact that you can see, the fact that you can smell, the fact that you can eat, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Now, why are we bothering to do that? Can any of you tell me why that first step is there?
It's to actually shift your mindset away from the issue and to, I used the term before. If you look at the average Australian, it's realizing that we actually live in the first world, and it's shifting away from the problem and looking at what our life is actually like.
Yes. It, I'm going to say the same thing in my language, John, but I mean the same thing as you're saying. It's to help us identify we're coming from a position of power. We're actually tackling this as a small potatoes issue. This is not a big deal. A big deal is you get cancer. A big deal is you smash your car and you get hurt. A big deal is a relative is suffering. Like, really, the point here is to help us recognize that we are coming from a position of power and that we have enormous ability to bring power to it. Because if you come from the position of struggle, you're depowering yourself when you start. So you nailed it in one, John. Okay, then.
Paul, I've just been through a situation. I mentioned it before about being accused for the first time in 30 years of managing at a senior level of bullying and harassing. And it's funny how it always happens when you're trying to performance manage somebody. So the company had to go through a full investigation. They hired a private investigator to investigate. And the guy wrote a report that was actually quite damning to me. And I thought, I might be being asked to leave here. So you could get concerned and worried. I've put 11 years into the business and I'm 2 years away from ending full-time work, but I'm not quite ready yet. But what I did was I sat down and said, okay, if that's going to happen, how do I get power in this? So I sat down and wrote a list of if they were going to end my employment, what they would have to pay me to end that employment so that I came out in a reasonably good position. And it gave me the power back. It didn't eventuate because they actually took my side in the issue and the other person has now left the business. So, yeah, but it was actually sitting down and thinking about that and saying, okay, if I'm going to, this is potentially going to happen to me, how do I want to control that? And I ran it past one of my colleagues as a CEO of another organisation, and she said, hey, that's a pretty good list you put together there. Yeah. But it gave me the power back.
Yeah, it does. Because can you describe what is the first word I would use that gave you the power back?
Control.
That's the second or third word.
Feeling.
Close.
Being present.
Close. Acceptance.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I don't like it. I never would have asked for it, but it is what's happening.
Yeah.
Once we practice acceptance, it doesn't matter what the subject is, you know. Once Gary can practice acceptance with his mum going blind, he's more empowered. He goes, okay, well, I don't like it. If I could change it, I would. But accepting that it is what it is gives me the power to address it as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that the smartest move there, John, is acceptance. Because acceptance allows you to say, okay, now what? All right, well, I've got a list of things.
Yeah.
Acceptance is at the root of what I was saying about the people in the bushfires. I accept that my house is burnt to the ground. I've got nothing left. In fact, I'm minus 200,000. What do we do now? What do we do now doesn't come until we practice acceptance.
Yeah.
A really important concept. That allows us, when we practice acceptance, to articulate the nature of the struggle accurately instead of emotionally. And that allows us to say what the actual costs in time and money are.
Yeah.
Okay, so once we've identified the costs in terms of time or money or frustration, then what we can do is, okay, what is the new thought? What is the new strategy? What are the alternatives that I can undertake? Think about that over the break, because we're about to go to a break. When we come back from the break, I'd like to see what you've come up with. So make a list of what's great about your life. That can just be single word things. And then a problem that you're struggling with, the cost to you in money or time or frustration or emotions, and then the alternatives that you can identify as a way to move forward. You do that over the break, then we all get to have a cup of tea and we can continue this on the other side of the break.